Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we begin a full session with Victor Davis Hanson, who is not only an established academic, a classic scholar and an historian of classical antiquity and a great military historian, but also a very active pundit, one might say. That word is used and misused a great deal, and it's often, in fact, these days, mispronounced, and they put an N in there and make it into pundit. There's no such thing as a pundit. A good pundit is somebody who really thinks through on the basis of a highly informed sense of what's going on and thinks through recent events to make sense of them in a way that relates to ultimate issues of value choice and relates also to historical precedent. A fair way of cataloging you, would you think, Victor?
I don't know. I don't live in Washington or New York, and I never have any insider information. And I tend to comment either from my office at the Stanford campus, but more often from my farm in Central California. So I'm kind of out of the loop in one sense. But
well,
I try to look at things in a historical perspective, and
exactly,
but without really interviewing the contemporary players on the scene.
Well, that's the best way to keep your balance and, in fact, to keep free of the nefarious influence they try to work on you. But a good way to get at this, to connect your interest in classical antiquity and military history, particularly of the Greek and Roman world, to the present moment, is to examine the assertion by Thucydides, and you've done a whole book on Thucydides, the first really great historian and the historian, in fact, of the Peloponnesian War, when he says in the opening pages that this book that he's giving us is not for the moment, it is a gift for all time, meaning you learn from history in a way that may have application 10, 20, 100, or possibly 2,000 years later.
Yeah, I think the key is not that history repeats itself, but that human nature is constant across time and space, and therefore humans will react in predictable ways, especially collectively. So when Thucydides said that, he didn't think there would be a Melian dialogue necessarily, or Mytilenean, or somebody exactly like Cleon, but he thought there would be people sort of like Cleon, and there would be instances of power versus morality like the Melians, and therefore mm-hmm. His history was supposed to be didactic. It was supposed to teach people as well as inform them.
The Melians, of course, lived on the island of Melos, and they were threatened by the Athenian ambassadors. You go along with us in this war, or else we're going to kill you all.
Yes.
And they decided, well, we're not going to go along, and they did kill all the men.
They did. And the Athenians, who at one time had been the great liberators of Greece,
had turned into tyrants.
Yes. The way that Thucydides chose to amplify that dialogue, he was trying to suggest that people who are liberators can be tyrants, and that realpolitik and interest of self-interest can trump morality. And then he's too clever or too brilliant a historian to make it just black and white, because they do say to the Melians, well, if we were to show generosity, human nature being what it is, people would think us to be weak.
Yeah.
And he doesn't really answer whether that's true or false.
Now, you've extended your examination of classical warfare, still on the Greek peninsula, but some years after the end of the Peloponnesian War, when the Spartans, when Sparta has continued to raid northward into the realm of Messenia and the realm of Thebes, and has continued to misuse the Helots, its slave laborers in neighboring areas. And another war breaks out in which Thebes, in essence, or Messenia, goes to war against the Spartans to reduce their power. Looking ultimately, in fact, at least their leading philosopher general announces that one purpose they've got is to bring democracy in the Greek model to Sparta, which has never had it.
Yes. Think Epaminondas lived about 60 years after the outbreak of the Peloponnesian
right.
War, and he was a student of that war, and he realized that the Athenians might have won had they focused more on a strategy they started but never completed, namely to free the Spartan Helots, the 200 or so thousand serfs that supplied the food for the Spartan army, so it didn't have to farm, and it could be a past masters in the art of war, and then to turn the Peloponnese, that is the private backyard of Sparta, into democratic strongholds. So in 371, out of nowhere, the Spartans, I mean, I shouldn't say out of nowhere, they invaded, as they usually did, Thebes, but out of nowhere, suddenly the Thebans decided to face them in battle, and they were outnumbered 2-3, and lo and behold, they won. That should have been the end of it. They expelled Sparta, but this unknown general got up and said, basically, next winter, which is very unusual in Greek history to march in the winter, we're going to take 60,000 people down to the Peloponnese, 180 miles away, and liberate all the serfs and found democratic cities in places like Megalopolis and Mycenae and ring Sparta in and essentially end it as a serious power. And he did exactly that. The tragedy is we don't know much about that because some of our extant historians, Epaphras is lost. Plutarch wrote a life of Epaminondas.
And that's lost too, isn't it? Yeah.
That's lost.
And Xenophon wrote about this, but those books of Xenophon's are also largely
well, he
lost,
didn't like. He was an intimate of King Agesilaus of Sparta.
Yeah.
And he was expelled. He had a farm on the near the Alpheus River. And when the expulsion of the Spartan garrison was completed, the Thebans and the Eleans got rid of Xenophon's farm. And the result of all that is, he goes out of his way not to mention Epaminondas, not to mention the freedom of the Helots, and it's almost as if they've been Trotskyized out of his history.
Now, here's what I want to get to. I'm about to pause right now to serve capitalism, which is all the more important these days, considering the anti-capitalist fervor that is on the streets in many cities, and to which President Obama seems to have lent some overt support today. I'll come to that on the basis of a recent, that is just within the last few hours, news release. But I still want to stay with this for a bit. And so here's the question I want to pose to you just before we go to those commercials. What struck me reading this fine novel of yours, which takes that whole war and novelizes it and also gives you a tremendous sense of Greek antique culture of that time, but the notion of war to implant democracy sounded strangely familiar, of course. It was essentially what we were talking about, what our government was talking about in the last government, that is, during the Bush years, when the Iraq invasion was undertaken. Is it conceivable that you can successfully implant and emplace democracy so that it will hold even beyond the time when you withdraw your troops? That's the question I want to get to, which means we're going to zero in for a little bit on Iraq right now, after we return from these messages.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Victor Davis Hanson, who's talking to us from his office at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. His new novel is titled The End of Sparta, and it is just published by Bloomsbury Press. And we'll get into that novel a bit before we finish tonight. But right now, take me to Iraq, Victor. And let me just point out that you were in favor of that war. You advised from a distance that it was a proper and appropriate thing to undertake. And basically, when others were rather critical and thought it wasn't working out and was too long and too difficult and an investment and it didn't seem to be paying off, they kept blowing each other up, the Shias and the Sunnis, and they also, we lost over 4,000 men there. You have remained steadfast in the judgment that it was worth doing and it's still worth carrying it through because, in fact, a democracy can be and to some degree has been established in that country. Do I summarize correctly?
Yes, I think the problem was that after 9/11, Saddam Hussein had attacked. We'd known he'd attacked four of his neighbors. He had terrorists like Abu Abbas. I don't need to go through all the litany because
no.
The Senate and the House voted for 23 writs. They had everything from the Marsh Arab genocide, much worse than Libya. So he was a mass murderer, over a million people killed, and it was in our strategic interest. I'm not sure Libya is. But nevertheless, I think the lesson of Iraq, especially in the context of the Arab Spring, it's very hard to implant constitutional government unless you are willing to spend the blood and treasure, something that's politically impossible now. But the United States did, and the result is that Iraq has not had the type of unrest that you saw in Egypt or Tunisia or Libya.
Well, Sunnis are still blowing up 20 or 30 Shias a day, aren't they? Or vice versa.
Attacked by a terrorist cadre. There's not a million people in the streets that overthrowing because the government's legitimate. It's been voted in. And it also, I think, is causing Iran a lot of problems in a way that's counterintuitive. We usually think that Iran subverted Iraq. I'm not sure that that'll be true in the long run. And then when you look at Syria, Iraq is in a much better condition than the government in Syria, I think even the government in Iran. And then moreover, I hate to say it, but when the president said, and I think it was in June 2009, that you cannot supplant, you can't force government by arms, I guess that's what he said in his Cairo speech, it's just not true. Today, Italy, South Korea, Japan, Germany, all of them have constitutional governments, and it's hard to see otherwise that they would have.
Well, we established democracy in those places, didn't we?
Yes, under coercion.
To be sure. Let me take you to the immediate matter that has so agitated me just this very afternoon because of a news release that I got. And this relates, well, I'm just going to read it to you directly. It relates to the protests on the streets, the Wall Street protest, which has diffused, as we know, to many other American cities and supposedly across the globe, though how serious those protests, whether in Rome or in London or where have you, are, one doesn't know. The press, if it wants to, can make an awful lot out of rather little. If 20 or 30 or 162 people sit down in a square for a while, it doesn't follow that it's a mass movement. All the same, we know how much the press has been following it here. Here's a story. This afternoon, in a call previewing Obama's upcoming bus tour through North Carolina and Virginia, White House spokesman Josh Earnest said, quote, "Obama will continue to acknowledge the frustration that he himself shares about," end quote, "about Washington's laggard response to the financial crisis." Earnest added that while on the trip, Obama will make it clear that he is fighting to make certain that the, quote, "interests of 99% of Americans are well represented." That struck me. The interests of 99% of Americans are well represented. That directly picks up on the rhetoric of the Wall Street sit-in bunch, that they are the 99% who are misused by the 1% of the oligarchs, the billionaires, who somehow don't deserve to have their money, and the wealth should be shared, and we want jobs, we want their jobs, etc. We know the fervor that has been expressed and the easy rhetoric that one picks up in little one-minute clips on a television interview. I'll just reread that sentence and go on for a moment. Earnest added that while on the trip, Obama will make it clear that he is fighting to make certain that the, quote, "interests of 99% of Americans are well represented," end quote, the first time the White House has used the term to differentiate the vast majority of Americans from the wealthy. Is this community organizer from Chicago now doing a community organizing job on the country, do you think?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people made fun of the so-called right wing, who suggested that when Obama lamented the lack of redistributive change, spread the wealth, his associates like Father Flager, Reverend Meeks, Reverend Wright, Bill Ayers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that was somehow demagogic or unfair or even quasi-racist. But what we've seen in the last 2.5 years is the same community organizing attitude. So he said, as president, that it wasn't no longer the time for Wall Street to profit. He said that at some point he thought you'd made enough money. He tried to shut down a Boeing plant. I could go on and get,
but at the same time, he's got a connection to Wall Street. Wall Street are funding him rather heavily.
That's what I was getting at, because he's got a problem, and that is it started in the Chicago organizing days when he lived in a mansion, and his wife and he probably together made $500,000, which put him way up in the 1%. And yet he demagogued as if he was a community organizer. Now, as president, he's trying to embrace Harry Truman rhetoric. But Harry Truman didn't go to Martha's Vineyard, and Harry Truman's best Truman didn't go to Costa del Sol, or she didn't go to Vail, or she, didn't go to these Tony resorts. Harry Truman didn't go to the most expensive golf resorts in the world. So Obama's got this ambiguity about him, and it's really channels into the protests themselves. You see these young kids, and not all of them are young, but they seem very affluent. And when you see these rappers, movie stars visiting them, And then the selective going to Rupert Murdoch's house to protest, you wonder, well, are they going to go to Al Gore's? Are they going to go to John Kerry's? Are they going to go to George Soros's? So who... It's not, I guess what I'm getting at, in the Obama mind, it's not necessarily who has money and who's culpable for having that money, but who has money and who is culpable because of their ideology.
So, what's your best guess about whether this was really a spontaneous uprising in New York, or whether it was somehow organized from a distance, and if serious money was poured into it, possibly Soros' money?
I don't know if we'll be able to answer that question, but I'll just say this, that when you have a president of the United States who for 3 years almost has been talking about corporate jets, millionaires and billionaires, people who junket to Vegas, et cetera, then that revs up the base. And when that rhetoric becomes intensified as he loses the independent vote and he needs every single person on the left to get out and vote, then the only way to get them out and vote and enthused is to do this class warfare rhetoric. And then the natural result of it is this Wall Street protest, which is very ironic, you see, because he had just given us a sermon after the Representative Gifford shooting that we all had to be careful what we've said, because people will interpret it different ways and it would cause greater divisiveness. Now he's said certain things, people have reacted, and you saw some of his signs were anti-Semitic, some of them were obscene, some of them were just communistic. And he's now actually, in circular fashion, reflecting off the protest. So he was a catalyst for it, and now he's a recipient of that enthusiasm.
How are they reasoning that this kind of identification with the protest might serve them well politically in the race to come?
Well, I think that they've decided that for a variety of reasons, they've lost the independent vote that propelled them to victory, and they just don't think they can get it back. So unlike Bill Clinton in 1995 after the 94 rebuke, he's not going to go to the center. But he does think that if he looks at these specialized groups, so he, and I'll give you an example. So get rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell by administrative fiat, get rid of the Defense of Marriage Act by administrative fiat, tell the Latino group that he wishes that he could do by administrative fiat an open borders policy, and he may do that, and then rev up the black base as he did with his sort of pseudo-Baptist preacher cadences and dropping the G's on his word, talking about bedroom slippers. So he's doing all of these specialized targeted appeals, and he hopes that he can cobble together 51%. He may be able to do it, but he's not running on what he said he was, and I think that's because he did it in 2008, and people now see that the curtain has been pulled, and they see who's behind the curtain with the gears, and it's Obama is always was a partisan, and we know that he had the most partisan voting record in the Senate when he ran for president in 2008. We know that his affiliations in Chicago were very, very radical, and yet he convinced the American people that when he said no more red state, no more blue state politics, that he was a centrist. Mm-hmm. Now he can't do that anymore. So he's got to go back to the Chicago mode and rev up the base.
Something else he's got going, we're about to pause right now for an update on the news, but I just want to plant this for directly when you return. Something else he's got going is a new website they set up, which has a chilling sort of conceptualization. You know about it. You've written about it. Attackwatch.com. And that's the third one, the third try to get people really to pull down the opposition, to defame the opposition, indeed to threaten the opposition in a way which might get them to shut up. It does begin to sound a little on the edge of 1984 to me, the Hate Goldstein operation. I think you even made that reference in one of your pieces recently. Directly back, let's look at that when we return, right after the update on the news from Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Victor Davis Hanson. Vic Hanson is to be read all over the place. Pajamas Media features his stuff regularly, as does the Chicago Tribune through the Tribune Syndicate, which spreads his columns around the country. Also, they are to be read in National Review. And for a larger Hanson fix, you can always go to magazines like Commentary, where you often find him. And, of course, you can go to his books. There are, as I said before, 15 before the current novel. In fact, I was wrong on that, Vic. I counted just again, and it's 17. And now, the 18th book in line is The End of Sparta, a novel by Victor Davis Hanson. But let me quickly, Vic, read from a news report when the thing was first announced about Attack Watch. Obama for Action, Obama for America National Field Director Jeremy Byrd said that the site offers, quote, new resources to fight back, including policy issue pages that fact check statements by Obama's Republican opponents with links to, quote, evidence to back them up. Its slogan is Get the Facts, Fight the Smears. According to the site, Obama volunteers can also help campaign headquarters keep track of attacks on the president by submitting reports via mail form and tweeting about them using the Twitter hashtag AttackWatch. The initiative is a throwback to a similar online effort launched by Team Obama during the 2008 campaign called Fight the Smears.
Yeah, well, we had Fight the Smears, and then we had journalists, and now we have Attack Watch. The Attack Watch is especially disturbing because it appears in this sort of Eastern European dossier fashion with black and red blaring contrast, and it's set up to look like an FBI file, and they have grainy pictures of the supposed perpetrator of unfair news or something about Obama, and then they ask the audience, the internet audience, to basically turn in people that have written things about Obama. Again, as in the case of our earlier discussion about wealth, demonizing wealth and then having an attraction toward the high life, this is all set in a landscape in which Obama said that he was going to end the Karl Rove politics. Well, George Bush never did anything like that. And Bill Clinton didn't do anything like that. He had a war room, et cetera. We haven't seen anything like that, in fact, since Richard Nixon. And there's a pattern here. But I think that has been very little discussed. Barack Obama is the first president in the history of campaign financing by the government, public financing, since 1976, to renounce it. And this was the great reformer. And he renounced it because he knew that he could raise $1 billion, much of it from Goldman Sachs and people like British Petroleum. So what he says and what he does, whether it's let's reach out and have civility or fund Attack Watch or benefit from journalists is a gigantic abyss. And same thing with the demagogic attacks on the war against terror. Had you listened carefully to Senator Obama and candidate Obama, you would have thought that Guantanamo was a stalag. Predators were airborne terror. Renditions were knocking on the door in the middle of the night, is what he said. Tribunals, preventive detention. I could go on. But since he's been president, he knew the media would not pick up on those issues because they were partisan rather than principled. So they dropped them. We don't hear about Guantanamo anymore, Iraq anymore, tribunals anymore. But he quintupled the number of predator drone assassinations. You can argue that that's in the national security interest of the United States, but my God, sending a Hellfire missile as judge, jury, and executioner of a suspected terrorist is a much more serious charge than waterboarding three confessed terrorists, three. And so what Obama says and what he does, there's this abyss, and it's predicated on the idea that he's charismatic, he's eloquent, he's rhetorical, he can say things and mask reality, and more importantly, he understands that many in the media are invested in his success.
You did a piece published in the National Review on October 8th, I think is the date, titled 10 Lessons from Obama. You don't have to, we don't necessarily have to go through all 10, but what you've just been saying is partly a reflection of what you wrote there. What else have you elaborated in that particular article, which I took to be a very important contribution?
Yeah, I think we all understand now that Keynesian economics is pretty much through because the narrative had been that Carter couldn't pull it off because he was an ineffective messenger. Clinton had the messenger down pat, but he didn't have the message. Suddenly, this messiah came, and he had both the Keynesian message, and he was an adept messenger. And so what more could you ask for to borrow almost $5 trillion in stimulus in less than 3 years, or to have zero interest rates, or to have 48 million people on food stamps, or 99 weeks of unemployment insurance, or have a government that's running a $1.6 trillion deficit that's $2 trillion larger than it was just 10 years ago. So this is Keynesian unimaginable levels. And I think the result will be the next time a presidential candidate or a president says that he needs to borrow $1.6 trillion to jumpstart the economy, nobody's going to believe him.
That's one of the lessons. What are the
anybody can say anymore that we want to have a culture of civility. I think that Obama's done that so many times and then gone right back and attacked in a very harsh way. Right after the Giffords, he said to the Latino group, we have to punish our enemies. And then he suggested anybody who wanted to force an immigration law wanted alligators and moats on the Rio Grande.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't think anybody believes that either. Another thing I really do think, and this is going to affect some Republican candidates, 2 years in the Senate without any signature legislation, just simply not enough experience to run the United States. Even his supporters who have become disillusioned are making that point. So I think that's going to be, it's going to be very important to have some executive experience.
What is the perception in the country now? We know what the perception was in 2008. It was the Messiah having, the political Messiah having arrived, and we were all very excited. And it was more than one kind of a strangely eloquent reporter who felt a thrill or something up his leg. But now, 3 years later, just about, what is the consensual view, or what views now are competing? Are there any who still, in fact, see him as something come from above virtually?
No, I don't think so. I think everybody realizes that he's the most partisan left-wing president that we've had since FDR, and that he's down.
Doesn't quite have the manners of FDR.
No, he doesn't. And he's down. And also, people are understanding that his eloquence is teleprompted rather than ad hoc. But we're getting down to the hardcore, the people who really do believe in redistributive change. It's always been about 25 to 35% of the country. 50% of the people essentially get money from the government. Another 48 don't pay income taxes. So he's appealing to that constituency, and he's promising them that he can use the agency of government to tax, regulate, take capital, and redistribute it through a technocratic bureaucracy. Okay, that's fine. That's what he's doing. But the dream that he was going to unite us all and he was going to usher in a new bipartisan center-left EU-like governance is over with. Nobody believes him anymore.
You've read the work of Saul Alinsky, undoubtedly.
Yes.
Is he still, in some basic manner, an Alinskyite?
Yeah, I think he
in
is.
In the methodology?
Saul Alinsky, if you just summarize his main point, I mean, he had many, but one of them was that you have to demonize the enemy and target him and isolate him and caricature him. And that's what Obama does. When he says millionaires and billionaires, he knows that if you raise taxes on millionaires, you're going to get about 2% of the money you need to balance the budget. Corporate jets, same thing. He knows that most of his friends fly on corporate jet. But he also knows that that demonizes that elite. And so when he lectures them that they've made enough money or it's not time to profit anymore, he's basically telling America that these people, them, are responsible for their collective unhappiness.
Well, this is really then stirring up class warfare, is it not?
Yeah, I think it is. But it's going to be very difficult to say that, you see, because he's so charismatic and he's rhetorical, he's post-racial, he's post-national, he's post all these other things, and yet that, and the media has been invested in him. So if somebody came from Mars and just looked at this administration, he'd say, wow.
What is the long-range cost, if there is any, to the collectivity, to maintaining something like the sort of national order or national unity that he says he wants, even as he is disrupting the consensual flow of common American identity?
Well, he's not just disrupting it. He's trying to tell his base that they are culpable and they are the following people. And these are the people who want to put alligators and moats in the Rio Grande. These are the people who fly around to the Super Bowl or to Vegas on corporate jets.
So this is, in a way, tearing the social fabric apart.
It is.
Will that tear hold, or will it heal itself
out? It did in the 1930s. It did in the 1960s and the McCarthy period in the 50s as well. So it's not wise. And then he's also doing things that I think that people don't quite grasp that are extra legal. So the Chrysler creditors are reversed by executive fiat. He promises that Chicano-Latino lobby that he's going to find a way basically not to enforce, and he's not. He just said that he's not going to deport illegal aliens unless they've committed a felony. He's going to not defend the Defense of Marriage Act. That's fine, but that's the law. And so he's going to have the National Labor Relations Board attempt to shut down a Boeing plant. He's having his EPA shut down power plants in Texas. All of these things are in a very gray area between administrative and legislative prerogatives.
Well, you know, Victor, again, it's time to serve capitalism. But let me pose this question. You reviewed it. You have reviewed it with great acuity, and as far as I'm concerned, with absolute accuracy. But still, what one needs to understand this is to put it in proper historical context, or to make proper history out of it, one has to understand what dynamic has created all of this. It isn't just the whims of one particular man. He was the man who the country chose at a crucial moment, and though his popularity has, to be sure, gone down, it's now about 40%, and he is in danger in terms of the electoral prospect, but still, there are many who yield to his preachments and yield to the symbols that he waves and yield even to his calls for division and for finding the new enemy and getting in their face. He's used that very phrase, and whatever that ultimately implies. One has to find some way of accounting for this. Does one do it simply by the psychology of the individual and confusion of the mass?
True, but we have to go back to the election.
Yeah. Well, let's do all of that when we return, right after we pause for this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And back to Victor Davis Hanson. Future historians, Victor, and maybe you'll undertake the task because you're a very active writer of history, though most of it has so far been focused on the ancient world. But future historians, once the Obama period, whether it's 4 years long or 8 years long, will have to unravel it and make some sense of how it all happened. And maybe you've got, I gather you've got some preliminary ideas on that, so let's hear them.
Yes, I think there was a sort of a perfect storm. Remember that even though 2008 was the first election since 1952 where there was an incumbent, which meant that just as Stevenson and Truman had, Stevenson and Eisenhower both ran against Truman, which hurt Stevenson, so McCain didn't defend the Bush record, he ran against it. So did Obama. It helped Obama more. Even with that, and even with the fact that media was very, very partisan, and even with the fact that people were very disenchanted with Iraq, and even with the fact that a lot of people were very, very interested in voting for the first African-American candidate for a variety of psychological and real reasons, even with all that, the McCain-Palin ticket was 3 or 4 points ahead on September 15th. Then you had the financial meltdown. That seemed to shift people. People's 401ks were wiped out. Their pensions were endangered. They saw this greedy Wall Street elite, and that moved the idea that maybe Fannie and Freddie and government securities had a primary role in it was just too esoteric. And Obama handled that much better than McCain did. So he was elected, and that was important because
hold on, one minute. What do you mean when you say he handled it better than McCain?
Well, remember McCain at first said he wanted to cancel the debates, or postpone them, excuse me, and then to postpone the campaign, and then he went to a presidential meeting, and people came out afterwards and said Obama was articulate and helpful, and McCain was silent and morose. And that, whether that was true or not, I don't know, but the narrative quickly came that this guy was cool, and McCain was herky-jerky at this great financial crisis of the times. And so, boy, at that point, he went up 4 points from being down four, and he never went back down. And there's another element, too. I don't think John McCain really did want to wage the kind of campaign that most Republicans and Democrats wage to win because of the delicate nature of running against an African-American serious candidate.
Yeah. But your impression of his 3 years now in office, as I've been reading various essays of yours, including the one I referenced a little while ago, the 10 Lessons essay, your impression seems to be that basically he's been overwhelmed by the job and has been rather inept at almost all of it.
Well, I think anybody would. That's what I think the left is starting to make that conclusion, that anybody who had no foreign affairs experience, no executive experience, more importantly, no sense that achievement has to be recognized for being achievement. So whether it's getting into Occidental or getting into Columbia or getting into Harvard Law Review or getting into Chicago, he never really played by the so-called rules. He even joked about his undergraduate transcript, but we don't know what it is. And when he got to Harvard, he was probably the only Harvard Law Review editor in the history of the law school that didn't write a single published article. I've never heard in academia, especially a renowned institution like the University of Chicago, willing to offer somebody tenure who was a lecturer with no publications. So he got the message that people, and he said this, I'm quoting almost verbatim, that people see what they want in him, said that in Dreams from My Father. So they invest in him, and he understood that, and that made him less accountable. And it gave him a sense of, I guess it's hubris, the idea that I can do these things and the media will fall into place and I don't have to be accountable. And you saw that almost immediately when he did not want to go to the 20th anniversary of NATO, the fall of the Berlin Wall in Germany, which is a key event, tear down this wall and that whole history. Instead, he earlier jetted all the way to Denmark to lobby for the Chicago Olympics.
Yes, he did.
And he thought that was his mere presence was going to do that.
The presence of himself and his wife.
Yeah, and you factor in the victory column and the fake Greek columns at the victory column in Berlin and the fake Greek columns and, you know, this strange, this is our moment, we're going to cool the planet and the seas will recede and all of that. Verbiage, and you get the idea that he really did think that he was going to do to the United States what he'd done to the Harvard Law Review staff or what he'd done to the Chicago Law faculty.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't know.
Why wouldn't he think that?
What he did to the Chicago Law faculty is a little bit more complicated than that. I have some privileged information, I guess. I'm not sure what I can and can't report from conversations I've had with various members of that faculty. But one thing that Richard Epstein, who's one of the leading members of that faculty.
Yes, he's a colleague of mine here at Hoover.
Yeah, yes. Do you see him much these days?
Yes, I do once in a while.
Wonderful. Yeah. You've probably had this conversation with him. One thing that that Richard Epstein said in a published piece was that one didn't really see Obama much at the law school. He was hardly ever in his office. And when Epstein tried to talk to him, Obama, just about issues in law or what have you, Obama was rather reticent to express any opinion at all.
I think the same thing has been said about his tenure at the Harvard Law Review. Same thing's been said about his undergraduate experience at Columbia. Same thing's been said about his Chicago legislative career, where he seemed to vote present rather than to make votes that might offend anybody or would be politically hazardous. Same thing is said about the U.S. Senate, that he was the author of no signature legislation other than voting the most partisan fashion, even more so than Jim DeMint. So there's a pattern here, but the country collectively suspended all of that skepticism.
We have to turn directly to some prognostication, at least on a speculative basis. Can he pull it off the second time around?
I think it's a 50-50 question. I think there's a good chance he can.
Yeah. Does it depend much upon who finally gets the Republican nomination and the method by which that nomination is achieved?
But it's also important. He's not going to campaign on unity, no more red state, no more blue state, stop the seas. He's not going to campaign on his record, unemployment, GDP, can't. This campaign is going to be a bare-knuckle Chicago style. They want to destroy your Social Security. They are quasi-racist. George Bush did this. George Bush did that. It's going to be a very negative campaign, and it's going to be designed to cobble together 51% of the vote from special interest constituencies.
Are the Republicans up to the task of mounting a strong competition?
I think they'll be much more vigorous than they were last time because when we've seen we've seen this one pastor that's associated with Perry say something that was quite derogatory about Mormonism, the media went after him. But the very thought now, it almost seems surreal, doesn't it, that in 2008, Obama's minister, from whom he got the slogan Audacity of Hope for his second book, actually said these things that were absolutely abject racist and anti-Semitic, and they were in front of a standing ovation often, at least from the clips. Mm-hmm. And then we had a quote with the Sun Times, I think it was 2004, when Obama told the religion editor that he'd never missed a single service. So all that
over a period of 20 years.
Yes, and he said every Sunday, 10 o'clock. So I guess what I'm saying is that looking back on that and juxtaposing those facts with any other candidate, he would have been politically ended at that moment. But Obama said he could know, his answer was to use the word typical white person, and he could no more disown Reverend Wright, and then Reverend Wright got emboldened and insulted the press, a stupid thing to do at the National Press Club a couple of weeks later, and then Obama flipped yet again. And all of that was known to people, and yet that didn't make a difference. My point being is that he can run a nasty campaign, a polarizing, Bush did it, cut Social Security, they're racist, alligators and moats campaign, you've made enough money at some point, and he may be able to get 51%.
Do you have a favorite candidate on the Republican side?
You know, I don't. I just am watching, and because I'm a syndicated columnist, I really don't like to endorse anybody.
Yeah.
But I think you and I and all your listeners know exactly what's happening, that they admire Romney in the abstract, but think he has fire in the belly, or he's conservative enough, or he's consistent enough. And that has led to this weird phenomenon that whether it's Michelle Bachmann or Chris Christie or Rick Perry or Donald Trump, that we have these great stone faces, so to speak, that is going to save everybody because we don't want to take the castor oil unless we have to. And yet we also know that we, being the Republican electorate, I'm an independent, but I'm just using that metaphorically. But the point being that Romney won't make a gaffe. Romney will not implode in August. Romney is well-financed. Romney looks good.
He keeps his cool, and he smiles, and he's well-informed.
Exactly. And so there's a lot of people. Half the Republican electorate says, you know what, let's go with a safe bet.
Yeah.
And the other half says, you know what, I'm tired of that. I did that with McCain, and where did it get us? I want Herman Cain. I want Donald Trump. I want Chris Christie. I want somebody who gets out there and mixes it up and has a consistent record of conservatism. So that's where we are. And I don't know how that's going to end. Either Romney's going to have to become more authentic and more emotional and passionate, or another alternative is going to have to be more sober and judicious, that doesn't worry people.
Well, Victor, we've so far been wandering around in the maze of American political life and political culture. We're about to pause for an update on the news. And then I want to take you to another location about which you've written a great deal. And I want to point up one particular article of yours just a little while ago, which scares the hell out of me. And I'm talking of the Middle East generally. And that article more specifically deals with the future of Israel. We'll be directly back to Victor Davis Hanson after the update on the evening's news from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
My guest tonight is Victor Davis Hanson, and he's been a guest on the program many times in the past. But tonight we've got him for 2 hours by himself alone, so to speak. And just a few quick words about Victor's career. He got his B.A. at the University of California, his Ph.D. at Stanford, and has taught at Stanford as a visiting lecturer or as a visiting professor. These days he is a fellow on the campus of Stanford University at the Hoover Institution. He won the Bradley Prize in 2006, and that's a very significant prize with a large, large financial aspect to it. Then the next year, 2007, he won the National Humanities Medal, which, as it happens, carries no financial reward at all, but is all the same a considerable honor. He has written for the Wall Street Journal, for the International Herald Tribune, for National Review, the Weekly Standard, the London Daily Telegraph, and is syndicated by this outfit based here in this very building, the Tribune Media Service. And he is, of course, a historian by training and background, and has done a vast amount of historical writing, much of it focused on wars of classical antiquity. And I want to come shortly to the war that is treated in his new novel, The End of Sparta. But first, going to a recent article of yours, published, I think, towards the end of September, an article which asks, can Israel survive? And indeed, just the opening paragraph, will Israel survive? The question hasn't really been asked since 1967. Then, a far weaker Israel was surrounded on all sides by Arab dictatorships that were equipped with sophisticated weapons from their nuclear patron, the Soviet Union. But now, things are far worse for the Jewish state. How so?
Well, from a historical point of view, when was Israel most in danger? And it was 67 and 73, maybe even more so, and much more so in 73. And so what were the conditions that made Israel so vulnerable? One was they had opposition states that were right on their borders, Jordan, Egypt, Syria. I think we're going to see that again with the change in government in Egypt. Second, they had a nuclear patron, the Soviet Union, that really adjudicated to what degree the war, when it turned in Israel's favor, could continue. And we may see another nuclear patron in Tehran. And then there was an ambiguous relationship with the United States. The strong relationship that we have today with Israel wasn't so in 1967 and was a little bit ambiguous even in 73, at least at the beginning of the Yom Kippur War. And I think that this administration has deliberately, as I think the term they used was, put some light in the relationship between Israel and the United States. And that was one of the first things they did when Hillary Clinton lambasted the so-called settlements. So we're starting to replicate some of the conditions that led to war in 67 and 73. We do know one thing, what causes wars in the Middle East and what ends them. And what causes them is when Israel's neighbors think they can win, win, and what ends them is when they think they're losing. That's all we know about the Middle East, essentially. So if Hezbollah and Hamas and the beleaguered Assad government and Iran and new radical movements in Egypt think that they can, in total, defeat Israel. At least they can shower them with 20 or 30,000 rockets that they all seem to have in their arsenals collectively. Then they're going to do it. And if they think they're going to lose, then they'll stop. I'm not sure they think they're going to lose anymore.
Now, we're focusing in on Egypt for the moment. You're saying that the new government and the putting aside of Hosni Mubarak essentially has also abandoned or is ready to absolutely disregard the peace treaty they signed with Israel.
Yeah, I think so. It's one of the tragedies of the Middle East reform. If the United States is not on the ground using force to insist on constitutional government, it's very unlikely it's going to emerge. And we have this phenomenon in the Middle East where dictatorial authoritarians, unfortunately, sometimes are even more liberal than their constituencies. So that when you have plebiscites without constitutional government, just plebiscites, then you reflect in the way ancient Athens was, an immediate 51% of popular opinion, and that tends to be very illiberal.
And what are your new suspicions, or what are your suspicions towards the new political regime in Libya?
Well, Libya, I mean, remember we were told it was a matter of, everything about Libya was tragic. I mean, we went in there to champion the United Nations and the Arab League. Remember, we didn't even ask, nor did we get congressional support in the way that Bush had in Afghanistan, Iraq. And so once we got the UN mandate, it said to offer humanitarian assistance and to have a no-fly zone. Immediately, we violated that by putting planes in the air to attack directly Gaddafi's forces. And so that was kind of, that bothered the Chinese, that bothered the Russians. Big deal, but it wasn't quite a multilateral foretaste of the new Obama, you know, utopia to come. And then second, we never knew who the rebels were. I had been to Libya once, and
you ruptured your appendix.
I ruptured my appendix. I almost died there. I had an operation, wood table in a clinic, and one sees almost immediately that there's a lot of undercurrents that Obama never addressed, mainly that a lot of the animosity is racial and it's religious because Gaddafi has hired 20, 30,000 mercenaries from Central Africa, and they're either animist or Christians, and they're black, and the Arab Muslim community despises them. And so we don't have any information on that, but we do have anecdotal reports that they execute prisoners, the rebels do, when they catch them. There's infighting among the rebels. And, of course, NATO's big three can't take out a two-bit thug in a country of 6 million people. They've been bombing for 9 months. So whatever it is, and I don't know what Libya is, but whatever it is, it's not going to be a model for anything. It's not going to be a model of how to use the UN and honor its mandate. We didn't do that. It's not going to be a model of decisive U.S. force. We've already called it leading from behind. Mm-hmm. It's not a model of working with rebels to insist that there's democratic, moderate reform government. That hasn't happened. We do suspect that the French and the British thought that this was a gold mine with 50 billion barrels in reserve of oil right on 200 miles away from Europe, and they thought Gaddafi was a day or 2 days from being deposed. They were going to jump in, cut a deal with the rebels, because it looked like they were going to win, and the United States came in shortly because they had been Susan Rice and Hillary Clinton and some other advisors basically shamed Obama and said, you were a day late and a dollar short on Tunisia and Egypt. It's time to get in here. It's a done deal. The rebels are going to win. The British and the French are already in there. They're going to get oil concessions. Let's get in there and help this humane cause. And nobody researched it. Nobody thought deeply about it.
Back to the focus on Israel. That same article of yours ends, I read the first paragraph. You have very interesting analysis through the article. And then you end with this last paragraph. So brace yourself. The next war against Israel is no longer a matter of if, only when. And it will be far more deadly than any we've witnessed in quite some time. That's, as I say, rather startling. As a judgment, you think the war is essentially inevitable. It's coming.
Well, I don't know how Israel, if we saw a foretaste in 2006 when Hezbollah had brilliantly embedded its teenage terrorists and insurgents and minutemen, whatever you want to call them, all through urban areas. And they had pre-stored weapons and munitions. They had a Photoshop pictures they released to the press. It was a media war. And they really outdid Israel in the sense of being able to tell the world that they were oppressed defenders against this juggernaut, and Israel was committing war crimes by bombing indiscriminately. So I think that was a paradigm, and if you look at the missile count, if I could use that term, the missiles that are in the arsenals of Iran, the missiles that are in the arsenals of Syria, the missiles that are under control of Hezbollah, the makeshift missiles that are in Hamas, especially now with the border of Egypt not being a problem of importation of weaponry, then you start to get into the several thousand. And so if Israel were to wake up one day, it could conceivably face 10, 20,000 missiles being let off of all different calibers.
Well, now, Victor, what then is Israel's capability, both in terms of ordnance and in terms of intention?
Well, Israel has to reestablish deterrence, and it has to do that.
They do that by a preemptive strike at some point?
I don't know, but they're going to have to let it be known very quickly and very clearly that the next time we get into a 2006-like scenario, they're not going to just reply on the enemy's terms. They're going to have to do things like they're going to have to tell the Assad government, or they're going to have to tell Hezbollah that if you do this, you're going to lose all your power. You're going to lose all of your infrastructure. So don't do it.
Do they threaten nuclear response?
I don't think they do unless they have intelligence that A, says that Iran already has the bomb, and B, is ready to use it. But this is something where the United States, you see, is not playing its traditional role. We used to step into the area and say, okay, you guys can publicly criticize Israel, but there's no daylight between us. So don't try the Turkish flotilla. Don't try the missiles from Gaza. Don't try...
So you're suggesting this has been, in essence, facilitated or eased along in this direction by the Obama government.
Yeah, I think go back to the Al Arabiya interview, the first he gave, the second day he was president. Yeah. He basically said that, I come from a Muslim family. I have Muslim relatives. I think that the Bush administration was culpable in the past. I want to outreach. And it was from the very beginning.
And then the Cairo speech as well.
Yeah, he never said Israel is a democratic constitutional state. Its allies are not. It produces more goods and services with 7 million people than 100 million people from Egypt all the way to Morocco. It's a unique culture. It's sort of like the Kurds, the Greeks, the Armenians, small peoples who are very unique and need to be protected because they're recipients of historical atrocity. And all of those peoples have been. And that was sort of what the United States understood. So we had always developed kind of relations with Greeks. We kind of like the Kurds. We kind of like the Armenians. We kind of like the Israelis. And we understood that, that if we didn't, nobody else would step up. And now there's a suspicion in the Arab world, the radical Arab world, that if they were to try something, the United States may secretly kind of sort of feel that Israel had it coming, or that this is just tit for tat, or but they would not fear an overwhelming American response.
Wherever the money comes from, somebody's been pouring a lot of money into a particular outfit based in Washington called J Street, which is to organize Jews in continued support of Obama, despite any disappointments they may have. And, of course, also to push the peace issue on the conservative government in Israel. Soros, I think, has put a fair amount of money in there. I think that's been demonstrated. And obviously, the Jewish vote in this country is a matter of some real concern these days for the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I think it is, especially because in this next...
Not only the Jewish vote, but also Jewish contributions.
Yes, in this next election, Florida will be crucial. Illinois will be crucial. Obama's even got problems in New York. So a small population that represents 3 to 4% of the electorate can make a huge impact in key states.
And that's why the next vice presidential candidate for the Republicans will be Senator Rubio.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
And I think that'll be a wise move on the Republicans' part.
Vic, we're overdue for some commercials. A brief stop and then directly back to Victor Davis Hanson.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Victor Davis Hanson. And at last we come to his novel, the brand new novel just recently published, The End of Sparta. You remember, Victor, a book title. I often quote the title itself. It was done by a fellow at the University of Chicago some 50 years ago. Ideas Have Consequences.
Yes.
One way to talk about your wonderful new novel, The End of Sparta, is that it demonstrates that that is true. In this case, they were the ideas of Pythagoras.
Yeah, they were. And in the novel, I tried to do something a little different. I just didn't want to tell an action story, but I wanted to immerse the reader into the culture, the religion, the values.
And you do that wonderfully well.
And then the language, because I was a translator of Greek text, I tried to think how a Greek would write it. So although it might be off-putting for a reader to just open up and see some Greek words, or the syntax is a little bit more Greek than English, the attempt was to take the reader and put him right into a completely different world of different values and a lot of the conflicts between not just oligarchy and democracy, but also things like Pythagoras versus polytheism versus slavery versus free.
The man who brings Pythagoras to the battlefield, so to speak, is Epaminondas.
Yes.
And you've got a new book coming about great generals, and most of them are Civil War or World War II, but one of them is Epaminondas, apparently.
Yes, and Themistocles the Athenian and Belisarius the Byzantine. And he's one of the great heroes of the ancient world. Cicero said he was the greatest Greek of all, Princeps Graeci, he called him.
Yeah.
But as I said earlier, we don't have much knowledge of him, so I try to reconstruct.
You imagine him very well, I must say.
Yeah.
He's one of the two leading characters. The other is a Cincinnatus type, but not in Rome, but rather in Greece.
I wrote a book called The Other Greeks a long time ago, which was a history of farming in the Western Greek in the Greek world and its effects on the modern and later Western agrarian tradition. So I knew a lot about farming, and I actually farm myself. So I tried to get a character, and I wanted to give both sides. So this character is very suspicious of Pythagoreanism. He has to be persuaded. He's only in it for his family, and then he, over the novel, evolves, and he becomes Epaminondas' greatest adherent. And the same thing about Sparta. It's sort of, I give a different, we after 300, we romanticize Sparta, and I try to suggest that, yes, they were great warriors, and yes, they were patriots, but there was something pernicious, almost, if I could use that term, it's overused, Nazi-like, in this systematic caste system that they used, and throwing people who were deformed, eugenics, into a gorge, or enslaving entire Mycenaean people. And yet, some of the characters that are Spartan, they make statements and they say things that have appeal to people. And so I try to essentially take the reader, put him right in the fourth century, and if he and I, my attitude was that I was not going to sort of use contemporary American language and just English words, and it was kind of an experiment, if I could say that word. I try to don't use words like second or moment, anything that in our English reference did not exist in the ancient world, and that took a lot of work.
Let me read a comment by one fellow, Paul Cartledge, who is a major professor of Greek culture at the University of Cambridge. And he says of this book, like Victor Davis Hanson, I have a fondness for the much-abused ancient Greek Thebans, and I entirely share his glowing admiration for Epaminondas of Thebes, Sparta's nemesis and the supreme philosopher-general of all antiquity. In The End of Sparta, his debut novel, the remarkable classical historian Hanson does full and equal justice to both the arms and the man. Arma virumque. Yes, indeed. It's a wonderful reading. I've had tremendous pleasure working through it over the last week or so, actually.
Well, thank you. I think it's, I try to do something different, and it's a challenge. It was a challenge for me. It's probably going to be a challenge to the reader, but I wanted to...
No, I think it reads I think it reads very well.
I was trying to immerse somebody, not just with Greek characters, but the way that they express themselves. So if there's a speech by Epaminondas or a speech by Lycus, one of the ways I would sort of frame it would go through the text of Herodotus or Thucydides mm-hmm. or Xenophon and see how speeches were given, or at least how they were recorded, the syntax, the vocabulary, the rhetorical devices. So whatever the novel is, I can at least guarantee the reader that there's nothing in that novel that is contrary, antithetical to what we know of Greek history.
I must ask you, one thing that you don't have in here that you should have is an identification of the art on the cover. It's obviously from a Greek urn, and it's a battle scene, but could you tell me any more about it?
Well, as a point of contention, I'm afraid, with my editors, because there had been a German artist in the 18th century that had gone to Sparta, and he had painted landscapes of Messenia, Mount Athome, mm-hmm. and they were beautiful, and they're in the museum in Munich, and I went all the way to Munich, got pictures, and wanted one of those, especially beautiful canvas of the brooding Mount Athome and Messenia and the Vale, as it looked in the 18th century, and as it probably looked in antiquity, but they chose to use a red figure vase of hoplite warriors fighting.
But it's still quite appropriate, I would think.
I think it is. But that was there, so they deserve credit for it because I didn't do it. I think it was only because I'd written two books that had Wars of the Ancient Greeks and the Western Way of War had that vase painting on the cover.
Oh, the same painting?
Not the same, but
similar
the same,
painting, yeah.
Same motif.
Sure. We're about to pause for a news report. And then let me say instantly to all who are listening, we want to go to the phones and to the email. Any question you've got, any response you've got to what you've heard in the last hour and a half of conversation, now's the time to get in there with question or with comment. 312-591-7200 is the number. The lines are open. I want my friends to get in there quickly. We want a lot of calls lined up after we take care of the news. 312-591-7200. And if you're listening over the internet at some greater distance and want to get to us via email, the email address is the same as ever, extension720@wgnradio.com. Extension 720 as one word, at wgnradio.com, or for phones, 312-591-7200. Get those calls and emails in instantly. If you've got anything to say or ask, we'll be with you right after the update on the news from Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And we will go directly to your calls and emails to Victor Davis Hanson. Whether you're focused in question or comment on contemporary American politics and contemporary American problems, or whether you're focused on what Victor has to say about the wars of the ancient world. 312-591-7200. Lines are still available. Get in there quickly if you want to join in this conversation at 312-591-7200. And first up is Gary. Good evening.
Yes, hello.
Yes, sir.
One question could be a big crowd of...
Oh, dear. We seem to have a problem.
Hello.
Yes, we're here, sir. Try again. Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, one question could be a big counterfactual. How would the country be better off
I don't know the nature of that problem, but it is a problem. I'm afraid we're going to have to let that call go. I think what I've got on my screen as a version of what the caller was about to ask was the following. Why can't Victor recommend a better presidential candidate than Obama? I'm going to try to plug the caller in again. Can you hear me now, sir?
Oh, yes.
Let's try once more.
I'm using my cell phone, and I'm having some echo. One question could be a big counterfactual that Milton's fond of. How would the country be better off if Mr. McCain had been elected? But I will stick with what I said to your nice screener. Why is it that even though you're a syndicated columnist, and I do like reading your columns, I don't have a great memory, but I'm sure you don't come across as one would say, a bleeding heart liberal. You would probably choose among the Republicans. Why don't you have a civic duty to recommend who you think would be the best next president after Mr. Obama?
Because we're a year away from the election.
Well, I mean, until it gets closer, as close as it gets, and then you could suggest. I'm not saying no.
Because I don't know I don't think any of us know the candidates. And at this time, if you look at any of the last elections, whether it was at this time we were talking, people were said that Giuliani, it was between Giuliani and Fred Thompson.
Yeah.
And so I don't know what Rick Perry is going to do in the next debate. I don't know what Romney is going to do in the next. I really have an open mind about it.
But
I don't know what this 999 plan that Herman Cain says. It sounds attractive, but I'm worried that he hasn't had an economic team evaluate it. It hasn't been discussed. And I think as we start to see two or three candidates emerge, then the media is really going to focus on them, and we're going to see how they wear.
Yeah,
and
I don't recall
it's so
your columns in
previous.
I'm afraid we have to let it go with that. I don't know how those things happen, but occasionally they do.
I mean, we do. With Obama, we do have a record. And I think if anybody would go back to January of 2009, when there were a lot of people who suggested he should fail, I said we should give him the benefit of the doubt. And yet he came out of the starting gates with health care. We had almost 10% unemployment. Excuse me, we had over 7% unemployment.
Yeah.
And we thought he was going to have some type of incentive for the private sector to start hiring. Instead, we got this massive, largest federal entitlement in our history. So it didn't make any sense.
Well, then we got some very large bailout contributions to a major industry as well.
We did. And the one
the
irony was that a lot of people were angry at George Bush because of $300 billion deficits, of spent borrowing $4 trillion, over 8 years, of bailing out failed banks. And then Obama was running on the anecdote of that. And what did he do? He matched the deficits in 2.5 years. And then the yearly deficits quadrupled. And then we had stimulus two, more bailouts. And we had a whole team, Geithner, Goolsbee, Romer, Summers, who all came in and assured us they had the answer, and it was classical Keynesian economics, and they're all gone.
That's what you get if you consult with economists from Harvard and the University of Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, it was almost as if they wanted to get out one day ahead of the posse.
Yeah.
I mean, they told us that if we didn't do this, we might get 10% unemployment. And now I can't think of any time where we have essentially no GDP growth, 9% unemployment, a ruined housing market, If you're a middle-class person and played by the rules and you have a little bit of capital, you're not going to get any money on your savings. Your mutual fund retirement account is probably going to go down, and you have no equity in your home. So we talk about the poor, which is important, and we demonize the rich. That's what people do. But what most people are middle class, and they've played by the rules, and they've saved. And this is the first time in my memory, and I'm 58, that having saved money or capital, it gives you no return on it.
Well, Victor, what could have been done differently in terms of economic policy?
I think if he had have come in, and dropped all of the class warfare, because much of it's psychological, and kept talking about small business, private business, praising him to the sky, saying you good people are the engine. That's number one. Number two, as you know from these new almost fantastic studies of energy exploration and new data on known reserves, we have a lot of new natural gas, oil in the Dakotas, offshore,
and there's a lot of jobs associated with that. If you start getting that,
we're spending $1 trillion a year to import energy, so we could get almost immediately 1.5 million jobs. And what did he do? He shut down much of the exploration in the West. He shut down some in the Gulf. He kept Alaska off limits.
And he went for solar and wind.
And then we spent several $100 billion subsidizing less suspect energy companies. So that was very critical. And then I wouldn't have done the Obamacare, because that just told the employer, this is a recession, but I want to warn you that next year or the year after, you're going to have to pay $3,000, $5,000, $7,000, and all you other people who played by the rules and have your private insurance plans, your premium will, as we know now, went up. So those things right there, from the very beginning, set a tone. And then it didn't help, as I said earlier, to demonize people and talk about fat cats and corporate people. Not at this area when you wanted to restore business confidence. And then, let's be frank, no less than Paul Krugman had written prior to his current incarnation that massive extensions in unemployment and food stamps can erode incentives for job seekers. He said that, not me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this record extension of unemployment insurance and the expansion of food stamps to 48 million people does take away incentives for people to scramble, to look for jobs. And I guess what I'm saying is that we are becoming an ossified EU-like economy where we depend on the government bureaucracy to open jobs. The government either subsidizes it several $100,000 per job growth, or it is job growth.
You know, you are quite aware, and it's reflected in one or two of the recent articles you've done, you're quite aware of the fact that civilizations rise and fall, that nations may come to a very bad end. The people go on, you say, but the political culture dissipates and disappears. Is it conceivable to you that that might even happen to us?
Well, I'm a little more confident, you see, because we have this singular constitution that really, at a time right now when there's unrest in the Middle East, there's strikes and violence in Europe, we have a little bit in the Wall Street thing, but we're a pretty stable country, and we're not a kleptocracy as you see in Russia, or we're not a one-state China Inc. as you see in China. So we have a very good political system still. We have enormous natural wealth. If we would not shut down 250,000 acres of farmland in California, if we would drill for energy, if we would not blow up dams but build them, we have natural wealth that we haven't begun to use. And then third, there's a ranking just the other day by the London Times, the top 200 universities in the world. Four of them were in bankrupt California of the top 12. Think of it. California and its low nadir has Caltech was rated the number one university in the world by the British and the Japanese, not us.
Yeah.
Berkeley, Stanford in California, then USC and UCLA. So what I'm getting at is the United States has the top universities in the world. It has some deplorable K-12 programs, but we have these assets that nobody else has. There's a reason why Steve Jobs was an American. There's a reason Google and Amazon and Facebook and all of these things, there's a reason why we're the biggest farm exporter in the world. So it's very hard to destroy the United States, and I think we can rebound. I think this is going to be cathartic for all of us, a good catharsis, because there had been an inclination among the American people to say, if we could only have cradle-to-grave European-like benefits, we might have bullet trains, and we might have all these health care benefits, and we could do that. And people were trying to tell them, no, no, you'll live with your parents till you're 40 while you're waiting for a government job to open up, at which point you can't be fired from it, and you'll have a little flat with a smart car if that's what you want. And they never really believed it. And now almost all of that's coming true, and people are rejecting it.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying, you know, I don't want a government-built Volt, and I don't want to pay increased taxes for a bullet train, and I don't want to give 60% of my income, state, federal, local, over to have a technocracy redistribute. And before Obama, I think there was that, well, what if? And now there's no what if. It's, we've been there, done that.
You have a wondrous capability to specify it and make it all concretely real, even to maintain and to exemplify the abstract analysis. That was a superb passage that you just went through. This whole conversation will be up tomorrow, of course, as a podcast on our website, wgnradio.com/extension720. Right now, we pause for a last round of commercials, then back for more calls at 312-591-7200. Some lines are available. If you want to get in there, move quickly, 312-591-7200, or for email, extension720@wgnradio.com.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
If you enjoy fiction at all, or if you don't read enough novels, but if you have a deep interest in history, either way, you must get your hands on this excellently wrought and profoundly informative, and at the same time, really rather exciting, book by Victor Davis Hanson, The End of Sparta. That is a novel, and it is published by Bloomsbury. And we go back to the phones, 312-591-7200. Tom joins us. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
Well, I'm pretty angry, and I'm calling to tell you why. I spent the first hour of your show listening to this gentleman who I admit is very angry.
Oh, dear, we're having the same problem. I think we'll just have to give up. He's angry, and he's spent the first hour listening to this gentleman, but Victor will never find out what he's angry about.
Things happen.
Yeah. Well, my engineers explained to me that there's a particular problem that's shown up today on our telephone system. I understand nothing about this, but we're going to have to give up phones for the rest of the evening. But that's all right. We've got some email here I want to read. And there's yet one big question I want to put to you. But let me go to one email instantly. And here it is. Here we go. I think your guest is missing the point by citing Obama's wealth as a reason to discount his tax proposal. By targeting the wealthy, Obama and his rich Hollywood supporters, in quotes, will be the ones who have to pay additional taxes. What could be more sincere than that? In my opinion, he is literally putting his money where his mouth is.
That would be true, but we're not. Most of the people who are the supporters of Obama, Sean Penn or an Oprah or Warren Buffett, the most prominent ones are George Soros or John Kerry or Al Gore. They're not in the $250,000 bracket. That's the upper middle class. Those are the top 5 to 7% of the small business people. What we're seeing is a very strange phenomenon of the ultra-rich are the most vocally in favor. And Obama has championed this. And
well, what do you make of that? Is that accumulating?
Said so, didn't he? He said it's going to hurt me, but it's not really going to hurt him.
No.
Because if you make over $500,000,
but he's not yet a billionaire.
No,
but he's just about a 10 millionaire, probably.
Yeah, I mean, if you are a multimillionaire, in other words, an additional percentage of your income tax is not going to be that deleterious. It is if you are in a $250,000 bracket. It really is. If you have 3 or 4 kids and you're running a business, it's going to be a disincentive. But when I hear Warren Buffett, or I hear Al Gore, or I hear John Kerry, or George Soros, Well, I don't know whether to laugh or cry because it's almost like a medieval penance. I'm going to do this, and then I'll feel good because I'm paying a little bit more
attention. By the way, what do you make of George Soros as a particular figure in our political life? He funds
I think it's one of the most strangest political developments of my lifetime.
Yes.
That somebody who broke the Bank of England through currency speculation and who's convicted of a felony in France and who just wrote his investors not to give him any more investments because he didn't want to comply with the new financial regulations has become an icon of the left just by simply the virtue that he's giving them money. So the whole Wall Street narrative, this protest against Wall Street, and much of Obama's language is against people who extract capital from the system unduly. Nobody, he's the epitome of that.
Exactly.
And yet he seems to get a complete exemption from any criticism on the left.
And
so
one doesn't,
it's the economic version of Guantanamo bad, tribunals bad, yeah. Renditions bad, preventive detention bad, predators bad. Oh, okay, now they're good because they're associated with Obama. And that's what's so strange. If I have a lot of Democratic members of my family, when I try to tell them that Obama was the largest recipient of Goldman Sachs or BP cash or, and renounced public campaign financing, they simply don't believe it.
I said I had one last thing I wanted to get into. We've got about 5 minutes left to do this. You're an academic. I'm a veteran academic, by now emeritus, but put in a lot of time at Yale, at Ohio State, at Dartmouth, and then a long, long run at the University of Chicago. You were in the California system. You've taught in many other universities on a visiting basis. I know you've got a continuing relationship with Hillsdale College in Michigan. And, of course, you're on the Stanford campus at the Hoover Institution, where you are a resident fellow. What's your sense of the utility and the clarity of mind of the American professoriate, particularly as regards the matters, the sorts of matters we've been discussing, and particularly as regards the social sciences and, for that matter, the humanities?
Well, you don't take them at their word because their word was diversity of thought, diversity of color, diversity, all diversity. But almost every statistic that we know of, however it's calibrated, suggests that the academic professoriate is 90% Democratic and liberal.
And how did they get that way, and why do they stay that way?
I think that's mechanical in the sense that they work in a system in which after 6 years you're guaranteed lifetime employment. That's not replicated anywhere else. And they have, as an academic of 21 years, I can tell you, as somebody who farmed, they're not comparable. When I was farming, I didn't know when my income was coming, 12-hour days one day and made no money. When I was an academic, I knew that I was going to be in the class 32 weeks a year, and we had an enormous teaching load, 4 classes a semester, but that meant still 12 hours in class. Most of our liberal arts professors are in class 6 to 8 hours, and like this...
You mean a week?
A week.
Yes.
And we're talking about hypocrisy, but my gosh, if you calibrate the treatment of part-time lecturers and part-time faculty who don't get benefits and are used deliberately by the university to subsidize grandees at the full professor level, it's much more exploitative than the Walmart greeter that the academic world is so critical of Walmart. But if you look at the pay difference between a part-time lecturer and a full professor and the benefits and the lifestyle, it's the most exploitative system in America. So I've never been able to figure out academia because it seemed to me that it was exploitive, it was unfair, it was not diverse, and it was not open-minded.
But I don't see how that necessarily leads all the recipients of that special set of benefits, leads them towards ultra-liberalism as virtually a religious commitment.
Well, put it this way. When I was farming, I was on a tractor 12 hours, and I saw my neighbor at the alleyway. We talked about the weather raising prices in the sense that we might not have an income.
Yeah.
When I was at the university, somebody would drop by my office and say, let's go have coffee for an hour or two and talk about Plato. Great. But I didn't worry that that moment I wasn't making money or I was going to lose my job or I wasn't productive. I just said, this is part of the job. It's discussion.
Yeah.
It was nice. I had a guaranteed income. And there's one other factor. And highly educated, highly informed people in academia tend to associate with other professions, law, medicine, commerce, and they get very angry because they feel that they're not compensated as well, and they don't factor
in
their lifestyle.
That is true, yeah.
And they get, there's a development of almost of envy there. And so they get very bitter at the system that a Renaissance scholar or a great professor of Italian literature doesn't make as much as a Goldman Sachs hedge fund.
Or as his friend in the law school.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there's so academia, from my experience, was full of envy and resentment. And it was tragic because the literature was so great and the students were so eager to learn. There was no need to try to. It was almost as if they said, we have you for 4 years, then the corporation,
well,
the religion, the family has you, so we're going to indoctrinate.
The saving thing is that the academic system also generates and throws into public activity and public pertinence somebody like Victor Davis Hanson. We're out of time, Vic. This has been a great conversation. I thank you so much for taking all this time with us tonight.
Thank you.
And hope to talk to you again soon. And with that, we wind down for the evening. Our guest has been Victor Davis Hanson. The full conversation that we've just completed will be on our website by tomorrow afternoon. That website for this and many hundreds of other programs, podcasts of hundreds of other programs, the website is simply wgnradio.com/extension720. We'll be with you tomorrow night at 10. Until then, thanks to all for listening and a most cordial good night.